All right, we're here with Dusty Wakeman, president of Mojave Audio. Welcome.
Howdy.
Oh, man, we're going to talk about microphones.
We're going to geek out so much. But so when the reason we are having Dusty on, many of you might know we're running a promotion right now, giving away a guitar and a Universal Audio recording rig and the Mojave mic.
So, I hope this podcast is out before the end of that
promotion. It should run, I think, through end of June, I think.
So. Awesome.
So if you haven't had a chance to enter, be sure to enter that sweepstakes. It's a really nice giveaway.
That's a good package.
Really, yeah. Really nice giveaway.
But we thought we'd have you on and chat a little bit about microphones. But what's interesting was we were kind of looking up you personally and realized, wow, Dusty's whole backstory is awesome and enough to do a podcast episode on. So how did you get to the point where you became president of Mojave Audio and doing microphones? Because it looked like you started out in the session musician and, yep, and recording world.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a whole nother career before Mojave Audio as a recording engineer and musician and studio owner. I owned a studio called Mad Dog that was in Venice, then in Burbank for 28 years.
Man.
Wow. And what genres of music did you record in?
Well, it was a commercial recording studio, so we did everything. My background is more in the Americana kind of guitars and drums world.
Okay. And because I saw, it looked like, was it early in your engineer career where you worked on Dwight Yoakam albums?
Yeah, I did Dwight's like first 10 records or something like that.
First 10?
Yeah.
Wow. He didn't say two, ladies and gentlemen, he said 10.
10, right.
First 10.
That's awesome. But
that's a little resume boost right there. That's
yeah,
awesome.
That was quite a ride because that's when Dwight was really, he's still Dwight Yoakam, but yeah, he was really big.
That was the era of that sound in country
right.
music.
Unbelievable.
Transformative Bakersfield kind of sound type era.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome. So you did engineering on that, and then did you play as well?
I didn't really play on Dwight's records. I was mostly engineer. His producer is a guy named Pete Anderson, mm-hmm, who's a guitar hero.
Yeah.
And Pete and I were like a producer-engineer team for about 15 years. And his thing is a little jazzier, bluesier than Dwight's stuff. And we worked with a lot of people, Michelle Schacht and I don't know. There's so many from Michelle Schacht to the Meat Puppets.
Oh wow!
Ooh,
just all sorts of different records that we did over that period.
Oh, very cool.
And then I kind of moved into production on my own after that, and worked with Lucinda Williams and Jim Lauderdale and some people like that.
Oh, that's awesome!
All big Americana people.
Well, do you have a favorite record that you worked on?
A favorite record that I worked on would be, well, probably the most fun I ever had making a record was a Jim Lauderdale record. And we made it out in the desert out near Joshua Tree.
Yeah.
In a big barn out there, and had this amazing mobile unit called Le Mobile, which was a vintage Neve and two Studers and, really state-of-the-art. Yeah. Remote truck. This is way before Pro Tools existed.
Wow.
So we were still using tape. And my wife and I used to own a guest ranch out near Joshua Tree,
okay,
a place called Rimrock Ranch. Uh-huh. And we all stayed there. I had Greg Lee. I don't know if you know Greg Lee's guitar or Buddy Miller, but these guys are monster musicians. They were all part of the band. And we just got up every day and went to the mobile unit and made this record. And it's an amazing record, amazing sounding record.
Okay.
But, it sold like 5 copies, but.
Hey, yeah, but sometimes those are the best. They were the most
fun.
Yeah,
I've got some unreleased stuff I did just, working as a production company that are some of my favorite recordings that have never seen the light of day.
So in the recording world, producing albums, eventually, switching over to the audio and the manufacturing side. How did you get into that?
Yeah, how did you get
into
mics?
Well, before, I'm from Texas, from Houston.
Okay.
And I had worked in music stores there. And I was in a band that was going to move to L.A. And during the time period that we were making plans to move to L.A., the band dissolved. But I was like, I need to go to L.A. And once I'd been out here, checked it out, It's like, that's where I need to be.
Yeah.
So I got a job at West LA Music.
Okay.
And worked there for 3 years. This was late 70s.
Wow.
Which was a great education and a great, we were talking about working at music stores. I guess all you guys worked in music stores.
A couple of us, yeah.
Which is, it's a great education.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, you know, all those contacts I made from working at West LA Music, I used to start Mad Dog in 1980.
Okay.
So we had kind of a built-in clientele from the very beginning.
What was the Mad Dog kind of setup? Was it like what kind of a board?
When we very first started, we had a Scully 16-track machine and a Tascam Model 10 board.
Okay.
And the board lasted about 6 months. Then we got an Autotronics 501 console, which is kind of a legendary console. It's what they had at Stax.
Yep.
They have one that looked just like ours.
I was just talking to Colin, our producer, about the Elvis Presley Live at Stax record. I listened to it. That's, if we're talking about music real quick, I was listening to it this weekend. I'm thinking to myself, man, like that's like everything that happened at Stax was so historical.
Right.
Things like that were just phenomenal. It's interesting to tie equipment to different records, right? And that's what we're looking at. Like different guitars. He used this guitar, this microphone.
Right.
So we'll probably nerd out about microphones a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. We shall. We shall.
That's awesome. And then
from there, we sold the Scully was funny because a guy had modified it for us to run at 30 ips.
Okay.
Because it only ran 7.5 and 15.
That's right there is beyond. That's where I'm off the nerd boat.
Well, that's the tape speed.
Oh, tape speed. Got it. Okay.
And 30 is twice as quiet as 15 is.
Okay.
So, you know, back then we were worried about noise more. And a guy had modified it to run 30, but the problem was the transport wasn't designed to run 30. So it was a tape eating machine.
Oh.
I used to have nightmares about it eating tape.
Yeah.
So we sold that and got an Atari MTR-90, which was a great machine.
Okay.
And then got a different board, got an Amec Angela board, and had that rig until about 1988 is when we got our first Neve and Studer machine.
Oh, wow.
And then it was Neve and Studer from then on.
Cool.
And the last version of Mad Dog, I had the killer Neve vintage console. It was an 8088, which is like an 8068, only made with 8 more channels.
Okay.
Very rare and just a dream console.
Wow.
We were talking at lunch. We were talking about an acquaintance we both have by the name of Paul Ill. And Paul used to work with, talk about our Beady Wolf podcast with Linda Perry.
He was
a studio bass player for Linda all the time. And they recorded at your studio.
Right.
I mean, it was like home for them.
Right.
And it was, where are you? I'm in Burbank. I'm at the studio. Believe it or not, only a few years ago, we didn't all use like Google Maps and GPS. So we just knew where to go.
Thomas Guide.
Thomas Guide, right. We would read a map or print it out on MapQuest. That was one thing that we would do. But anyway, it was almost like, where are you going to be, Paul? I'll meet you at Mad Dog.
Right.
It's such a killer studio.
Yeah, it was a great place. We had 3 rooms. We had a big sound stage. And it was quite an operation.
That's awesome. And so when did you kind of transition out of the studio, you're running the studio then?
Well, after 9/11 happened, the record industry kind of dove off a cliff and the major labels stopped doing artist development.
Oh, in like the early 2000s
when
the music distribution all changed, right?
Yeah, everything changed.
Everything changed.
And, you know, we had a really nice studio. Most of our business was producers like David Bianco and Sylvia Massey and Joe Barisi and Joe Ciccarelli, people like that, doing bands that were on their first major label deal.
Right.
So they would have like $150,000 to $250,000.
Big budgets. And,
right.
Yeah.
Not so big that they would go to Capitol or East West, but, you know, they wanted an even studio room, a big room to track in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that just dried up. You know, they just stopped signing bands.
Huh.
And I was busy producing lots of Americana and indie stuff. And, you know, that I could still be doing that if I wanted to.
Right.
That's ongoing and a healthy part of the business. But I got in the kid business and kids. And had been working, you know, 6-7 days a week.
Yeah, long late night hours.
Yeah,
probably.
10-12 hours a day for years and years, and just having a blast. But I kind of burned out on it.
Yeah,
and saw the change happening in the industry, and there was so many studios in LA at that time. Yeah. It was really competitive. Rates were getting lower and lower. So
there were.
I had discovered Royer Mics, which is our sister company, along the way,
mm-hmm.
and bought some ribbon mics.
Yeah, they're famous for the ribbon mics, right?
Yeah, they kind of brought ribbon mics back from the dead,
right?
And modernized them. And I had bought some of those and got to be friends with a guy named John Jennings, who was the VP of sales and marketing for Royer Labs.
Okay,
and he would bring prototypes over to do R&D at my studio, and I would borrow mics from him. If I was doing a big band date or something like that, I'd get a box full of Royers to use.
Oh, okay.
And got to be close friends, and just a conversation one night, he brought over a prototype of the MA-200, which is our first microphone.
Okay.
And I immediately said, man, that sounds like a U67. What's up with that? And found out what they were going to sell it for. And that just led to a discussion about what they were going to do with this new company they were starting.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of looking around for something else to do. And I had the background from West LA Music to be able to kind of transition into that world without any problem.
Yeah.
Cool.
So that was in 2005. I went to Burning Man my first time, came back and started a new career.
You had to reset at Burning Man.
You had to reset.
Burning Man, exactly. Oh.
And that's probably before Burning Man kind of became this kind of corporate, you know, well, not, I don't know, I haven't been, but, you know, I know the Coachellas and all those things are now getting very popular. That was probably before it was that popular.
Yeah, well, you know, Burning Man was always better last year.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, that's cool. And so since you joined then in 2005 with Mojave, was it called Mojave Audio?
Yeah, it's called Mojave Audio.
Okay.
And that name actually predates Royer Labs. The genius, the autistic genius who designs our microphones is a guy named David Royer.
Oh, okay.
And he's who like reinvented the ribbon mic.
Yep.
And before Royer Labs even existed, he was hand-making mics in his garage in Fullerton.
Okay.
Under the Mojave name.
Ah, interesting.
Oh, yeah. So it's a rebirth of the brand.
Exactly. Exactly. The modern version.
Wow. And so so you guys are focused on the everything not ribbon microphone.
Right. We do condenser mics.
Okay, cool. I guess for our listenership, I guess it would be important to establish like what is a ribbon mic and what is a condenser mic, just so that they're aware of what we're bringing up as we start to geek out.
Well, there's three main categories of microphones, which are condenser microphones, dynamic microphones, and ribbon microphones.
Okay.
And ribbon microphones actually technically are dynamic because it's called a moving coil.
Okay.
Condenser microphones use a diaphragm and a backplate, and there's an electrical charge there. It's actually a capacitance.
You have to add power to it.
Right,
yeah.
Right. There's a little amplifier inside the microphone. That's why condenser microphones all use phantom power.
Got it.
48 volt.
That little button you got to press on the...
It won't work without that little button.
Yeah.
So if you plug your condenser in and you can't figure out why you're not getting any output or input, for that matter, check for a button that says 48 volts.
Right.
Push it.
Okay.
Right. And then two microphones all have external power supplies.
Because
you got to supply some extra voltages for the tubes.
For the tube. And tube microphones are condenser microphones.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. And then for dynamic and...
Dynamic is just a physical coil that moves. You know, so all the instruments, a guitar generates, you know, waves of sound. And that causes something to vibrate,
mm-hmm.
whether it's the diaphragm in a condenser or the coil in a dynamic microphone or the ribbon in a ribbon microphone.
Okay.
And that's what generates the current that turns into audio.
Got it. Got it. Okay, cool. So you guys started with the MA-200.
Right.
Oh.
It's
such a good microphone.
It's a real workhorse. It's a fixed cardioid mic. And after that, we came out with the MA-300, which is the kind of the big brother to it. It's the same capsule, but it's got a pad and a filter, and it's got a continuously variable pattern selector.
So a little bit more options on the table for that.
More options, right? More versatility.
What are those types of microphones good for, condenser microphones?
Well, they're really workhorses. They're really good. You know, I hate to say they're great for everything, but they really are. Mm-hmm. I mean, vocals is probably number one application. Acoustic guitars, of course, is a big application. But drum overheads, they sound great on pianos.
So if you're somebody that's starting their home studio and getting a very simple setup, probably a condenser microphone is the first thing that they'd want to look at.
Yeah, or maybe the second. You know, the first might be an SM57 or, you know, an inexpensive dynamic.
That's the most popular, dynamic microphone for electric guitar amplifiers or snare drums or things like that.
Yeah, and a lot of people are using them for everything. They're singing on them.
Oh, really? Okay.
Sure. Yeah. You know, until they step up and buy their first condenser mic.
Right.
So a lot of times it's, you know, somebody's been recording for a while at home and is ready to move up. That's when they're ready to get a Mojave.
Got it. What's something that somebody that's just getting into it, what's like a common mistake that a lot of people do with, let's say, recording acoustic guitars or something like that? What are some very basic things that people can do to make sure they're headed in the right direction?
Right. Well, probably the obvious first mistake people make is putting the mic right on the sound hole.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because it's just, okay, that's where the sound comes out.
It's called the sound hole.
I should put the mic there. And you really get a boomy sound when you put it on the sound hole.
Yeah.
You get way too much low-end information.
Okay.
So that's probably mistake number one that I see people making.
Yeah. Where do you recommend that they start then?
Well, the good old 12th fret is always a good place to start.
Okay.
If you're using one microphone, somewhere around the 12th fret or where the neck meets the body, and maybe 8 to 10 inches away or a foot away is good. You know, the thing that home recording people are fighting is acoustics.
The stuff bouncing off
around
the room.
Right, they're recording in a bedroom or something like that. And a square box has the worst acoustics.
That was the biggest thing that I overlooked when I first started was I had an audio engineer friend of mine come over to my house because I was like, you know, I'm just not getting a really good sound. And I bought this really nice microphone, or I thought it was really nice.
Right.
And the first thing he did was he wasn't even looking at the microphone. He was looking at the room and clapping around it and kind of checking things out. And he said, well, you should be sitting over here when you record and facing this direction.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and put some stuff up here. And most of the time he spent dialing me in was just dialing in the room.
Yeah, it's overlooked a lot.
Yeah.
It's overlooked. When I did work at retail, I mean, that was another add-on. A lot of the time when people would buy a recording gear, I'd talk first and foremost about their room. Rich guy comes in and says, I want the most expensive thing you have. It doesn't matter if the room is wildly square.
And the better the microphone, the more you're going to pick up
the
stuff in the room.
Well, that's, I think, what you get with a lot of the studios, and what it's probably lost now is the fact that many of these studios have these just amazing sounding rooms with different characteristics that people were like, I'm going to record here because it has this room. They weren't talking about the mics the studio had. They talk about the tracking room.
Right.
What are other things that people can think about when they're recording?
Well, before we move off of acoustics, there's so many cheap, simple fixes, things that you can do. You know, you can get some moving blankets and just drape them over some mic stands and kind of surround yourself with that. You can open your closet door where the clothes are hanging and sit right in front of that.
Yeah. What is a role of a producer, and is that something that somebody should consider even as a, you know, if they're paying for their own recording to work with a producer?
Well, hopefully, you know, they're going to end up with an engineer that can do some of that.
Okay.
But a producer, I mean, you wear a lot of different hats, but the scenario you're talking about, you know, you would get together first with the artist and go over the songs, make sure the songs are arranged properly.
Oh, so even before down.
Yeah, pre-production.
Okay.
You go in and really come up with a game plan and try to get it to where when you walk in the studio, you're just going for a performance.
Yeah.
You know, and make sure you got the right guitar and the, you know, the right key and the right tempo and all those things before you go in the studio, and then talk about arrangement. And, you know, if you're going to have any other musicians play, help cast those roles.
Mm-hmm. You know, where would somebody find producers like that and kind of assemble that to make their song come to life?
1-800-producer.com.
Yeah, right? Like, is there? Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
or should they start looking on the backs of the, well, I guess you can't look on the back of CDs because there's no CDs anymore.
Liner notes, yeah.
You can look at liner notes online.
Yeah.
And find out who produced your favorite records. And
on liner notes.
on liner notes, right.
We just figured it out.
That's where we are.
But I mean, you know, because I remember it's like I was checking out some of the websites of some of the producers and I was like, oh, well, that's just only a couple $1,000. I mean, that's not $150,000,
right.
You know?
Right.
So in a way, it's a little bit easier, I think, for somebody a favorite record to reach out and find out that, hey, this is the engineer that worked on that, and I can actually, this is a real person I can get a hold of and,
right.
And have on my song,
right.
You know?
Sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, engineers and producers love to work.
Yeah,
they do.
They're always looking for that next project.
Yeah. It's wild. Some of the producers that when I worked and lived in Los Angeles, some of the things even looking at liner notes, we're talking about liner notes, right? And you're looking at it and you're like, this album was mastered by, and like you keep seeing like Brian Big Bass Gardner or
right.
something like that. And I'm like, this guy, he's got to be great. He's got a nickname called Big Bass. And then, you know, it was a matter of, I remember one of the records we were about to put out, I needed a mastering engineer, and it was just like, oh, we got this guy Brian Gardner, he can do it, Big Bass, you know. And I'm like, oh, it's that easy. That's it.
Right.
You don't have to be in right. an exclusive crowd to find,
well, because they're not
producers
and they're not all working on, you know, Billboard top songs every single day of the year.
Right.
And there's a couple of those maybe a year or every couple of years, but the rest of the time there's their bread and butter is probably
yeah,
doing
work.
A lot of.
I mean, you know, producers
you figure
and engineers
most
work.
Records that are made never see the light of day.
Yeah,
you know,
that's pretty crazy to imagine, actually. Yeah.
So there's a whole industry going on that of stuff that we don't know about.
We just hear what's on the radio, and for every one hit on the radio, there's hundreds of songs that made it to recording and producing and everything that finally just didn't get
right. Maybe accepted. Didn't get released or.
Wow.
Or if it got released, it didn't get promoted.
Well, you know, before we go, you know, what are kind of the flagship microphones that Mojave puts out that listeners should consider for their tailors?
Well, we introduced a couple of years ago one called the MA50.
Okay.
We wanted to have a mic that sold for under $500.
Okay.
So we worked really hard on it. It's a transformerless mic. And, really to compete with the Neumann TLM-103s and 102s.
Oh, yeah.
Which this mic costs half as much and sounds twice as good.
Okay.
It's a great starter mic.
You heard it here.
You heard it here first.
You heard it here.
MA-50.
Okay. And then it goes, you know, you work your way up through our models to the MA-1000, which is kind of our high-end. It's inspired by a Telefunken 251, which is pretty much the holy grail of vintage 2 mics.
That's the holy grail of vintage 2 mics.
25 grand when you can find one.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's David Royer's interpretation of a 251 with a better transformer.
Okay. Cool.
And that one goes for $27.95.
Okay.
So that's our range. We were really the first company to make great sounding mics in kind of the mid-range price-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we started, nobody was doing that.
Okay.
And we're manufacturing and taking advantage of Chinese manufacturing,
okay,
but using really high-grade American parts.
Okay.
Like the transformers and the tubes and the FETs and all that stuff are all sourced here.
But then you do the quality control.
In Burbank, yeah.
In Burbank.
David Royer still listens to every mic before it goes out.
Okay, cool.
All the tube mics we burn in for 24 hours and...
Nice. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for being on. It's been fun.
Oh, yeah, and, man. It's great. Thanks for having me.
And we hope listeners get a chance to enter the sweepstakes. And if you have any questions for Dusty or for us regarding home recording or anything like that, or if you need any more information, just email us ftf@taylorguitars.com. Or you can give us a call at customer service. You can find our information on taylorguitars.com. And thanks for listening to the Taylor Guitars from the Factory podcast.